Esther chapter 7 this morning. We've gone back to this wonderful book. And today we are looking at the demise of this man, Haman. And at this point in the story, there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of hesitation we've seen in Esther. And of course, there's courage as well as determination by Esther to stand in the gap for her Jewish people. Now, some have asked, if Esther hadn't gone to the king, what would have happened? Well, two things would have happened. Number one, Esther would have missed out on the blessing of being God's instrument to deliver her people. That's the first thing. The second thing is, God would have found another way to save his people. Because God had promised way, way back in the Old Testament, before Esther was even born, that the Messiah would come through the Jewish people and through the tribe of Judah. So God would have found a way. God has a million ways, a billion ways to accomplish his purpose. But if Esther hadn't have gone, and hadn't taken her stand, and hadn't pleaded for her people, she would have missed out on the blessing of being God's instrument. Now, by contrast to Esther, who's on the way up spiritually in this story, Haman is on the way down. And at the end of chapter 6, his wife and his friends told him in verse 13, Esther 6, verse 13, they said, "If Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but thou shalt surely fall before him." Haman is already heading downwards. God is warning him, even talking through his wife and his friends, and saying to him, "Listen, you're fighting against God, Haman. You're resisting God's will. And the Jewish people, if you're falling before them, you're going to keep falling. God's going to deal with you." Haman, sad to say, doesn't listen to the warnings that God gives him. There's a little verse in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 11, that tells us that depravity, the hardness of the man's heart, teaches man and blinds man to presume on God's forgiveness and God's grace. The longer God allows them to get away with sin, the more they assume they can get away with more. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 11, the verse says this, and have we found it, please? Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11. Put it on the screen. Well, let me read it for you. It says, "Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil." Let me read it again. "Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil." In other words, because God doesn't cut everybody off the moment they sin, the moment they do great sin, people assume, "I can get away with it. In fact, I can do worse and get away with it." They seem to think that God's mercy is forever. It lasts forever. And it doesn't. And Haman is about to discover that all the windows of mercy that are now open to him are about to close. And as he leaves his house that day to attend the banquet, this will be the last meal he'll ever eat on this earth. This will be the last 24 hours he has on this earth. And he's presuming on God, that God is not going to deal with him. Now, in chapter 7, verse 1, the king and Haman enter this banquet with Esther. And the king speaks to Esther again, and he says in verse 2, what is thy petition? What's your request? Why do you keep asking me to come for a meal? Why did you come to my throne in the first place? What is the issue that's bothering you? And he promises to her, it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? And it shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom. Now that's a big offer, because this is a very wealthy man. This is a man who owns and controls the biggest empire in the world at that time. And he says to Esther, what is it you want? I'm willing to do for you what you want, up to the half of my kingdom. Now, Solomon tells us in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, there's a time to speak and there's a time to keep silent. And wisdom and maturity allows you to learn when is the right time to speak and when is the right time to keep silent. And Esther here discerns. She understands. This is my moment to speak. Everything is now ready. The king has said 3 times, whatever you ask, I'll give it to you. Whatever you request, I'll perform it. Haman, he's nervous. He's on edge because the day before, everything has not turned out the way he thought it was going to turn out. He's had a big humiliation. He's unnerved. His wife and his friends are telling him, listen, you're in trouble, mate. You're on the way down. And the king has spoken 3 times, and it's going to be very hard for him to back off his commitment to Esther. So Esther has waited patiently. No doubt she's fasted and prayed, asking God's help in this period of time. And I suspect God has led her to speak only at this time and only at this place. And she opens her mouth and she begins to speak. And let me just ask you a question. Are you sensitive as a person to know when to speak and when to keep quiet? Are you willing to wait on God and wait until God leads you when to speak and what to speak? Well, that's a skill, you know. That's a gift. There are a lot of people who open their mouth and anything comes out. And what can come out can be things that do great harm, not just to themselves, but to others. And Esther's a wise woman. She may be a very beautiful woman, but she's not some empty-headed model, is she? She's a wise lady. And you'll just see how she speaks and what she speaks will reveal that her heart is a very wise heart. Because she knows how to handle this very difficult person, Ahasuerus. And of course, how to get the better of that wicked, cunning rascal, Haman. This is very difficult for her. Now, no doubt her heart is beating very fast. But she speaks, and notice how she handles this. And as you read her speech, notice what she leaves out. Notice how careful she is with her words, how respectful she is with her words. She begins by saying in verse 3, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king. So she says to the king, I respect you. I respect your position. And I'm not here to demand. He has said to her, you can ask and I'll give it. Many of us would say, okay, here's my demand. I want, bang, 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 bang. But she doesn't. She knows how to handle this man. And she says, if I have found favor. She shows that she's under his will. She's not trying to take over his role. She shows that she's submissive to him. She's wise and careful. Now, this is not a pleasant man to be around, Ahasuerus. He's selfish, he's ruthless, he's cold, he's immoral, he's an adulterer. He's not someone that you really want to be with. But she's there, and she this is the one she has to be before, and she handles this very wisely. She begins by giving him great respect. And her strategy is to use an indirect approach. She won't come out directly and say what she wants. She works this man very carefully and uses very careful words to get him to the conclusion that she wants to lead him to. I wonder, did she remember the story of Nathan the prophet with King David? If you remember way back in 2 Samuel, how King David, Nathan approached him in a very indirect way about his sin. And how Nathan told him the story of the parable of the man who had just a little sheep and the man who had a great flock. And how the man with the great flock stole the little sheep, the only little lamb that this man had. And he used that parable to get David to a position where David spoke. And then he says, "You're the man, David, I'm talking about." I wonder, did Esther remember that story? Because Nathan used a strategy like that with the king. And Esther's before a king. And she's going to bring this man indirectly to the conclusion. And throughout the whole thing, she never mentions she's a Jew. She never mentions that her people are Jewish, even in this statement that she makes to this king. She's indirect. She's tactful. She's careful. And she says to the king, "If it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request." Now, she doesn't say which people it is. Haman may not even know yet it's the Jews, because he has no idea that she's Jewish. And he's just listening. The king's just listening. And Esther's drawing the king to respond. And what she wants the king to do is to say, "I guarantee you, your people will be saved and your life will be saved." Before she turns around and says, "My people are the Jewish people and my life is a Jewish life." See how clever she is? She's carefully getting the king on side. And what she's doing as well is she's putting the authority on the king and the responsibility on the king to protect her life. Remember, she's the wife. She's the queen. And to attack the queen is to attack the king. She's trying to stir up the pride of this man. Can anybody touch your wife? Can anybody hurt your wife and you not respond? And she says to this king, "Will you protect me? Will you protect my relatives, my people?" And of course, what she's trying to get is the king to say, "Yes, of course, Esther. Absolutely. Tell me how to do it. Who's trying to attack you?" That's what she's leading him to say. Now, she could have stood up and said, "Well, I just need to tell you this. I'm a Jew and my people are Jewish and this guy Haman is trying to kill them." Well, that could have created all kinds of problems for her if she had approached it that way. Because the king could have said, "Well, why didn't you tell me you were a Jew? Why have you been hiding this from me?" And Haman could have used that to drive a wedge between the king and his wife. So she's very careful and very wise. She's not an empty-headed, beauty queen. She's a very clever woman. And then she goes on in verse 4. She says, "For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish." It's been already agreed. Now, the king was the one who sold them. Ahasuerus. But she's clever, Esther. She doesn't put the blame on the king. She doesn't mention his involvement, his stupidity, his rashness. You know, a lot of wives would have lost control and they would have said, "You're the one to blame. It's your fault, Ahasuerus." But no, she's clever. She handles this very volatile man, this ruthless man, very, very wisely. And then she says this, verse 4, "But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue." So she says, if the king had decided to sell us, or we had been sold into slavery, I would have kept quiet. Because Ahasuerus thinks everybody belongs to him anyway. No point trying to argue that point. She doesn't argue the morality of killing her people, because Ahasuerus thinks nothing of killing people randomly. So she avoids that argument. She just says, if we had been sold into slavery, okay, well, I would accept that because you're the king. We're your subjects. We're your people. But then she's very clever at the very end of verse 4. She says, although the enemy, so she puts the responsibility on the attempt to destroy her and her people on another person, not the king. Although the enemy hasn't told us yet who it is, but has separated the enemy from the king. See how she does this. Although the enemy could not countervail the king. In other words, is wanting to steal from the king. So she's telling Ahasuerus, this person or this group of person who's trying to destroy me and my people, they're actually trying to destroy the king's prophet, the king's people. The king's going to lose out. And Ahasuerus is a man who, you know, he values his wallet. He values his resources. And Esther's very clever to appeal to the pride of this man and the greed of this man. She doesn't talk about spiritual things because there's no point talking to this man about spiritual things, because he's not a spiritual man. So the only appeal she has to this man is, you're going to lose out. And I'm going to be destroyed, and my people are going to be destroyed. And you have promised to take care of us, Ahasuerus. You're the king. And someone has done this behind your back. Now, what does she want the king to do? She wants to stir up the pride and the anger of Ahasuerus. She wants him to act. And very cleverly, she draws him to this conclusion. Because notice how he speaks, verse 5. Then the king Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, who is he? He doesn't even guess that it's Haman. He has no idea that Esther's a Jew, even at this point, and that the Jewish people are the ones under the threat. He says, who is this man? Where is he? That durst, or that whose heart, the actual Hebrew means this, whose heart is filled with this malice, this evil against you and your people. Now, remember, right at this moment, Haman doesn't know it's him. The king doesn't know it's Haman. The only person who knows is Esther. You see how clever she is? How wise? She's carefully concealed. And of course, there's an element of reaping and sowing here, because Haman held back the information from the king that the Jews were the people he wanted to see destroyed, to get the king to sign the decree. And now Esther's doing the same to him. God's allowing Esther to do the same, to make Haman reap what he sowed. He sowed deceit. Now he's going to be caught out in this situation. And Esther waits to the very last second before she reveals the bombshell. And she says in verse 6, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. You don't need a PhD to understand her, do you? She just looks at him and says, this is it. This is him. And immediately Haman is caught off guard. He has no strategy to do. He has no plans. Suddenly, this is not what he was expecting. And the king is furious because his pride is hurt. He's been fooled. He's been taken advantage of. And he's been told that this man, Haman, whom he trusted, is now trying to kill his queen and steal his money by destroying his people. And he rises up in anger. Now, remember, he's been drinking. It's a drinking banquet. The alcohol's flowing. And if you know anything about alcohol and people, it's not a good combination. We lose control of our emotions very easily under any kind of influence of alcohol. And this king, he's angry. And Haman, he sobers up very quickly, because he immediately discerns the king is against me. In fact, he says he saw that there was evil determined against him. He's cunning enough to quickly waken up and realize, I'm in trouble here, big, big trouble. This is a death sentence if the king believes this woman, that I am guilty of this. I'm going to die. Now, what happens? Verse 8. Well, verse 7 first. Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther, the queen. Sad to say, instead of repenting for his sin to God, Haman just wants to save his life, his miserable life on this earth. But isn't it ironic? Here's the man who got so angry when Mordecai refused to bow down to him, a Jew. And now here we have, in 24 hours, him bowing down before Mordecai the Jew, and him now bowing down before Esther the Jew. See what God can do? See what God can turn around? See how God can make men and women do what they don't want to do? Bow the knee when they don't want to bow the knee? And now he's pleading for his life, begging for his life. And then verse 8 says, then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine. And Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. Don't miss this little statement. Start of verse 8. Then the king. Exactly at the right moment, at the right time, the king came in to discover Haman was at the bed of the queen. You know, if Haman had been thinking right, if he hadn't been unnerved, you know what I think he would have done? When the king left and went out to the garden, Haman, being a very cunning guy and a very clever with words, he would have followed the king out, wouldn't he? And he would have tried to manipulate the king and said, she's lying, you know, it's all a misunderstanding. You can hear people talk like that, don't you? That's just a misunderstanding. No big deal. Maybe I've overstepped the mark slightly. I should have investigated this better. But we can solve this. And I'll apologize to the queen, and I'll take a rap on the knuckles, and all this can be sorted out, and the king doesn't have to lose any face by changing his law. There's a way to solve this. And maybe he could have said to the king, listen, let's just not tell anybody Esther's a Jew, and we'll preserve Esther's life, and we'll all keep it quiet, and it'll all work itself out. I think that's what he would have tried. Or he may have spoken to Ahasuerus and said, listen, let me just go on and deal with the Jews, and I'll make you a rich man, Ahasuerus. I promised you all of this money. I'll get it for you, and if I don't, then you can take my life. He could have tried bargaining. He could have tried pleading. He could have tried all types of manipulation. But God, in his providence, leaves him there, unnerves him, and he makes a big mistake in falling down at the queen's bed. Because as you know, we have mentioned this before, no other men were to come in the presence of the queen but the king. Ahasuerus and the Persians were very, very strict on this. They certainly were not to touch them, because they were seen as the king's personal property. And for Haman to fall like this, and I suspect Haman thought that he's very, you know, he probably fancied himself as a bit of a charmer. And he probably thought, well, Esther, you know, I could manipulate her. She's probably attracted to me secretly anyway. And I could maybe negotiate with her and get her to intervene with the king and save my life. And then maybe her and I could get married in the future and we'll be king and queen. Maybe I could offer her that. I mean, this old guy Ahasuerus, he's going to die soon anyway. But when the king comes in, just at the right time and the right place to see him where he shouldn't be, the king is even more angered. And the king says in verse 8, will he force the queen also? In other words, will he attack or rape the queen before me? Now Esther, remember, has told him, Haman wants to kill me. And now when he comes in, he sees Haman at her bed. And Ahasuerus says, there's the evidence. Guilty. And the king says, it says in verse 8, as the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Those servants and soldiers, bodyguards, they must have heard the commotion or they must have been nearby. And as soon as they heard the king make those remarks, they knew it's a death sentence. And they covered the face of Haman to prepare him for death. Wow, what a turnaround. Verse 9, and Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, behold also the gallows 50 cubits high, 75 feet high, but the height of this building, which Haman hath made for Mordecai, who hath spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman. Let me ask you a question. Do you think it was a coincidence that Harbona was there at that moment in time? That Harbona heard the conversation between the king and Haman? Do you think it was a coincidence that Harbona remembered the 75-foot gallows that Haman had built to kill Mordecai on? Do you think that's a coincidence? No. God had that man there at the right place, at the right time, to allow Haman to reap exactly what he sowed for others. No mistake. And you know, if you let God lead your life, you'll discover that God will come through, even in the small details, at the right time, at the right place. Through unexpected people will intervene to help you. Mordecai may not even have known this guy, Harbona. They're not even related. One's a Jew and one's a Persian or some other race. And yet God gets this man, Harbona, to speak on behalf of Esther and Mordecai. And what does the king do as soon as he hears these words? Verse 9, then the king said, hang him thereon. Let him die. And let him die on the gallows that he constructed for someone else. Now remember why Haman had built the gallows 75 feet high? He had built them 75 feet high so that everybody in the Persian Empire and everybody in the city of Shushan would know how great he is, that if you offend me, you die like this. If you let me lose face, I'll take your life. To show how great he was, to show how powerful he was, and the very symbol of his pride became his downfall. God allowed him to die on those great gallows so that the whole of the city could see Haman is not as big as he thought he was. In fact, Haman's a nobody. Haman is yesterday's man. Haman has been wiped out by God. You know, at the end of chapter 6, we read it earlier, Haman's wife and his friends warned him, you have put your finger on the Jewish people and God is coming after you. But he wouldn't listen. And now, Haman is paying the price. For his own pride, for his own arrogance, for his own hatred of the Jewish people. And you know, verse 10 says, so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. If you ever saw a symbol in the Old Testament of reaping what you sowed, it's that one, isn't it? If you ever saw a lesson, an illustration of God taking care of his people and preserving his people, there's the incident, isn't it? Let me read you a verse from Psalm 49. Psalm 49, verse 16 and 17. Psalm 49, we'll put it on the screen. Now, sometimes, you know, it's easy to get intimidated by powerful people in the world that we live in. And one of the things that makes people powerful in our society in particular is riches, wealth, possessions. And people are always intimidated by someone who has possessions. And the psalmist says this in verse 16 of Psalm 49. Be not thou afraid when one is made rich, when the glory of his house is increased. Now you say to me, well, why? They are intimidating. People who've got possessions and power and wealth, they are intimidating. They are frightening. Well, here's the answer. Read the next verse, verse 17. For when he dieth, he shall carry what? Nothing away. Nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him. Here today, gone tomorrow. Haman was one of the richest men in Persia. How much of his riches did he take with him that day? Nothing. Nothing. How much glory and power did he bring with him into eternity? Nothing. Nothing. I told you the story before of the very rich man who passed away, multimillionaire. And his children were all gathered at the solicitor's office, the lawyer's office, to hear the reading of his will. And they were all very excited, waiting to hear what they got. And the old solicitor, he got the piece of paper out. And normally in these wills, they have this long preamble. They read out, you know, of all the technical language, and they go on and on and on. And this solicitor, of course, he's getting paid by the hour, so he's dragging it out. And he's going on and on and on. And eventually, the wife of one of the sons, she got very impatient. And she said, excuse me, how much did he leave? Because that's the big number she wanted to hear. And the old solicitor put down the will. He took his glasses off and he looked at her and he just said one word. Everything. Everything. Because you leave everything. You can bring nothing with you into eternity. The Egyptians, they didn't believe that. They built these massive pyramids, didn't they? And they put the old pharaohs in there, and they filled the pyramids with gold and silver and all kinds of things. And they said, he needs all this money for the next life. What did they discover when they opened the pyramids? The gold, the silver, still there. But he's not there. He's had to leave it all behind. And the psalmist says to you and I, don't be intimidated by the Hamans of this world. They may strut around like a little peacock, you know, boasting in their wealth and their power and their prestige. But remember this, life is just a very short time. You're here today and you're gone tomorrow. James says in his epistle, life is like a vapor. Boil your kettle and watch the vapor. Well, how does it go? It just comes up out of the kettle and then what? A few seconds later, it's gone. You know, if you talk to an old person, I'm not old. Not that old. But if you talk to someone in their 70s or 80s, you've lived life, do you know what they'll say to you? I can't believe how fast it's gone. I still think I left school just a few years ago. Then I discover it's nearly 30 years ago. I met some people at my mother's funeral who I'd gone to school with. I didn't even recognize them. In fact, I saw one, he looked so old, he had no hair, he was all wringled. I thought to myself, he's this old man coming. And he was the year below me at school, even worse. Even worse. Well, life just comes. Life just goes. And if you get intimidated by those who have wealth and power today, remind yourself, listen, they're not beyond the throne too long. The Hamans don't last forever. And you're going to run into the Hamans, not just in the society, in the workplace. Maybe you're in a home today and there's a Haman running that home. He's proud, he's troublesome, who's out to destroy you and upset you. Maybe you go to the workplace tomorrow morning and there's a whole lot of little Hamans. And you're upset about it. You're angry even. You're saying, where's God? God, what are you doing? Read Psalm 49. And you discover they're not going to be here very long. They come and they go. In fact, Haman's life can be summed up in 24 hours by four H's. You know what the four H's are? Number one, honored. The king honored him, made him prime minister. Number two, humiliated. The king made him bring Mordecai around the city, honored his enemy Mordecai. Number three, H, he's horrified when Esther says, you are the man, you're the one, you're the enemy. And you know what the final H is? Hanged. Four H's, 24 hours. Went from honor to being hung. You see what God can do in 24 hours? Just let God take care of these situations. And what a difference a day makes when God's on the throne. The book of Esther, you know, is not a book that's simply to entertain us. Although the children love to be entertained. My son said to me last Sunday during the Bible reading, he said, when are we getting to the bit about the killing of the bad guy? I said, just wait a week. We'll get there. The children love the story, don't they? Every year the Jews celebrate the Feast of Purim. It's to remember this incident. And the little Jewish children, every time they read out the book of Esther, they come to Haman's name. Do you know what they do? They bang the table and say, cursed be his name. And it's almost like a story. It's almost like, you know what, Aesop's Fables or some other, you know, mythical story. Oh, this is not a story just to entertain you and I. The hero in this story is not Esther. The Jewish people are not delivered because Esther has a very clever scheme to deliver them. No, the hero in this story is not Mordecai. It's not Esther. Is God. And you and I are to read this story and see the fingerprints of God all over every verse, working and weaving and guiding and directing all of his perfect plan through the lives of all of these individuals to save the Jewish people from destruction, to preserve them from people like Haman. That's the hero of the story. And you know, the God who weaved his perfect plan in the life of Esther and Mordecai and even Haman and Ahasuerus, the God who weaved all of these events and circumstances, he's still at work today. This is why this is not just an entertaining story. Because the God of Esther and the God who stood behind Mordecai is standing behind you today. He's working through your life. He's drawing all the threads together. And with all the threads, he's weaving a perfect pattern, a beautiful pattern, that one day you'll see the final result. You know, when I was a boy, my grandmother and my mother used to knit. And we used to get bored watching them all the time. And they would knit and knit any spare time. They would sit in the corner and they'd be working away. And what they were knitting, you didn't see. It was just a lump of wool. It was this wool, and it always got in the way. It annoyed us because it fell all over the place. And they're working away, this clack, 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 clack. But then at the end of a period of time, they would put the knitting needles down. And they would take that piece of wool, or what was left of the wool, and they would say, "This is what I have made. A beautiful cardigan to keep you warm in the winter, or sweater, or pair of socks." And from all those threads, they had weaved something beautiful, or knitted something beautiful. And you know, that's just what God is doing in your life. The threads, you may not understand what each individual one is doing, but he's working them together to produce something beautiful and something useful. And you know, you just need patience, that's all. Just need to wait. It's not over. Life's not over yet. Our day does not end when we're laid in the grave, in the coffin. Our day is just beginning. Because eternity lasts for eternity. "I give unto my sheep," he says, "everlasting life. And they shall not perish." You know, trapped in our little world, we tend to forget those things, don't we? We tend to make snap judgments and conclusions too quickly about God. One last verse. We'll put it on the screen. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 5. It says this. Let's read it together. "Therefore, judge nothing before the time, until the Lord come, who both will bring to light the hidden things of darkness, and will make manifest the counsels of the hearts, and then shall every man have praise of God." Do you have a Haman in your life today? Read that verse. Judge nothing before the time. Don't make a snap judgment. Don't presume what God's doing. Just be patient. And if you just wait on God, God will take care of the Hamans of this world. Just be patient. Many years ago, 60 years ago, in the land of Scotland, young man called John Muir, who was a preacher, received a phone call one day from the owner of a ship. And the owner said, "Listen, there's a young sailor who's been on my ship and he's seriously injured. And he might even die. And he's in the hospital in Glasgow." He says, "I want you to go and visit him and talk to him." John Muir went to that hospital that day, 1952 it was. And he saw this young sailor. And he wondered, "What should I talk to him about?" And he put his hand in his pocket and he pulled out a tract of Pilgrim's Progress, the story of Pilgrim's Progress. How the young pilgrim had a burden of sin. And he brought that burden of sin to the cross and the burden rolled away at the cross of Calvary. And he said to that young sailor, "Listen," he says, "I want to ask you a question. Do you have a burden in your heart today of sin? Are you carrying the guilt of a conscience because of the sin that you have done in your past? Have you got that guilty conscience and that burden? And the young man said, I do. I'm not ready to die. Not ready to meet God. John Muir said to him, listen, bring your burden to Jesus, and the burdens can be lifted and rolled away. He says, let's pray together. And if you want to have your burden rolled away, you ask the Lord to do that. They prayed together. He said, amen. And he looked up, and the young man looked at him, and he smiled, and he said, the burden has rolled away. John Muir left the hospital, went home, got a piece of paper, and was thinking of exactly what had happened that day in that hospital. He got a pen, began to write. And he wrote these words, days are filled with sorrow and care. Hearts are lonely and drear. Burdens are lifted at Calvary. Jesus is very near. But there's another stanza. It says this, cast your care on Jesus today. Leave your worry and fear. Burdens are lifted at Calvary. Jesus is very near. You know, as you walk around Lucky Plaza, what do you see? You see these Filipino women with these big bags. You never see them? Almost as big as them, and they're carrying them around, all their possessions. And the burden is a heavy one, isn't it? And you feel like saying, let someone carry it for you. And you know, if someone carries it from them, it's no longer heavy, is it? Someone has taken the burden. And if you're here today and you're carrying a burden of care and concern and anxiety and fear and discouragement, you do what that song says, cast your care upon Jesus' day. Christian, you have to get rid of your burden too. It says, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. He says, give it to me. Why carry it around? You know, God has been running this world for 6,000 years. He doesn't need your help. You ever thought about that? He doesn't need your advice. Just let him run the world. You just do your job. Don't you worry about tomorrow. That's his problem. You just get your life right today. Isn't that right? If you're here and you're not even a Christian, you can discover that the burden of sin can also be got rid of today. Not at the church, but at the cross, if you bring it to the Lord Jesus Christ. Burdens are lifted at Calvary. Calvary, Calvary. Burdens are lifted at Calvary. Jesus is very near. He's here today for the Christian, for the unbeliever. And he says, whatever burden you have, give it to me. Don't carry it around any longer. Don't carry that big bag, you know, every floor, up and down the escalators. It's as if Jesus is standing at the basement of Lucky Plaza and he says, just give it to me. Just give it to me. I'll take care of it. Go you on. No need to carry anymore. And if you're stupid, you keep carrying it. Isn't that right? But if you've got a wise head, you say, okay, I'll give it to Jesus. Why should I burden myself anymore? Cast all your care upon me, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7. For he careth for you. He's willing, he's able to take your burden. Let us pray. Father, we thank thee for what we have heard today from Esther chapter 7. Jesus is very near. He's always willing to take our burdens. He will deal with the Hamans of this world in his time, in his way, and in his place. Lord, help us not to fret about the future, but let us trust the God who controls the future. For we'll discover that if we just wait on you, that you will work everything out in your time and in your place. Help us not to judge a matter before the time. Judge nothing before the time. The Bible tells us that it'll all end well for the child of God. Help us not just to say those things, but believe it. For we ask these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.